talking to me?
Funny, like I'm a clown, I amuse you.
Here's Johnny.
He's looking at you, kid.
We're on a mission from God.
We are Movie Geeks. Welcome to the We Are Movie Geeks podcast. Today is August 10th. This is our 11th weekly podcast, in case you're keeping score at home. My name is Tom Stockman.
Michelle McHugh.
Jim Batts.
And we are here to talk about movies because that's what we do. Top 10 at the box office. Oh my gosh, they had a Marvel movie opening over the weekend. You know, all those Marvel movies always come in number one. Was this weekend any exception, Michelle?
It was not. Actually, Mission Impossible Rogue Nation hung on to the number one spot. The film was number one at the U.S. box office for a second weekend with an estimated $29.4
million. Mm-hmm.
The film also opened up in 18 new countries this weekend as it earned $94.9 million worldwide.
But Fantastic Four opened.
Fantastic Four opened up at number two from 20th Century Fox. That opened up to bad reviews.
Well, I should clarify something, Tom. Now, it's Marvel Studios films that had opened at one, number one. This is from Fox.
And Fox is hanging on to that hardcore. They are not letting it go.
Give it up, Fox.
Okay, yep.
We'll be talking about that here in a couple of minutes. We all three saw that.
Yeah. That opened up at $26 million. Yeah. The Gift opened up at $12
million. Yeah, not great, but it couldn't have cost much more than $12
million. Oh, yeah.
It's an intimate film.
Yeah.
Small cast.
Oh, yeah. I think it's probably going to make its money back by next week. Yeah. I think.
Number four was Warner Brothers Vacation at $9 million. Number five was Ant-Man, $7.8 million. There's your Marvel.
Hanging tight there. You know, I was talking about that with a friend. Who would have think they could make a fairly successful film about Ant-Man? It still boggles my mind.
Well, we all thought it was really fun.
Oh, it's a blast. Yeah. But the character has been kind of a joke for so long at Marvel Comics, and it's just amazing to me.
Number six was Minions, $7.4 million. Number seven was Jonathan Demme's Ricky and the Flash.
Mm-hmm.
$7 million, starring Meryl Streep.
Yeah.
Number eight was Trainwreck, $6.3 million. Number nine was Sony's Pixel movie, $5.4 million. Rounding out the top ten was Southpaw from the Weinstein Company at $4.8
million. Mm-hmm.
And the adorable Shaun the Sheep from Lionsgate opened up to $4.8 million.
And it did not crack the top ten. We reviewed that last week, and Michelle and I had seen it, and we both really liked it. We thought it was hilarious.
Well, I've heard some people online, or read some people online, saying that the problem might be the marketing of that film.
That's what we were just saying. I think people look at the ads and think it's kind of a movie for three-year-olds.
Yeah, that's the impression I kind of got from it.
Yeah.
And that's the impression your kids got from it originally, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if you're not a fan of Aardman and you don't know the backstory and whatnot, you might have said, yeah, that's not for me.
Yeah, this is like a Teletubbies movie or something.
Exactly.
You know, it's not.
But, no, it's not. And it's too bad, too, because it's really a fun, wonderful animated film.
Mm-hmm. And as you said in your review, it's going to give Inside Out a run for its money come Oscar time. I really think it will.
Yeah.
The Academy just had an Aardman series this past weekend, so it was a full weekend of all their movies.
Well, we saw three big premieres last week. Let's start with The Gift.
It's not over.
Simon, after all these years, I was willing to let bygones be bygones.
What does that mean?
I do not know.
I reviewed The Gift. I gave it four out of five stars. I thought The Gift was a terrific little thriller. Did you see? You didn't see it. Jim
saw
it.
Yeah, I saw it. Yeah. I saw it with you there. Yeah, it's a nice compact kind of low key thriller. They like I say, the marketing on that is kind of deceptive. Also, they want to. I think you mentioned that it wants to be look like a bunny boiler in the commercials and trailers.
Yeah.
And that this killer is stalking this sweet innocent couple, and without giving a lot away, the couple's not so sweet and innocent, and there's a lot more going on than just he's outside. Oh my gosh,
the ending. I'm not going to give away the ending, but a lot of these, even Fatal Attraction, which sort of set the template for these type of revenge movies, ended with a shootout and a home invasion and death and screaming and stabbing and somebody emerging victorious. The Gift ends on a much more cerebral, sort of more satisfying note. You know, somebody gets their comeuppance, but I really, really like the ending of The Gift.
Yeah, I don't know if you mentioned in your review, but it might have been. It's odd that the main selling point of the film is Joel Edgerton as Gordo, and he kind of disappears for about a half hour in the movie, doesn't he?
I did mention that in my review, and it gives Jason Bateman and Rebecca Hall time to really flesh out their characters, and you really change your sympathies to them. I thought Jason Bateman was really, really strong. Rebecca Hall, who I've really, really liked in a lot of movies, she's really one of my favorite sort of new actresses. I liked her in Vicky Cristina Barcelona and the one that Michelle and I saw last year called The Awakening.
Mm-hmm.
She was, in Iron Man 3. She had a small part.
She's
been hopping around for a few years now. I thought she played it too much of a victim, and there was this one sort of uncomfortable subplot that's given away near the end. That
it's kind of referencing something that's been in the news the last few months.
Yes, involving a certain Jell-O pudding spokesman.
Mm. And it's a little rough. She does somewhat take control a little bit. She becomes sort of a junior Nancy Drew about two thirds of the way through the flick, because her husband Jason Bateman is just shutting her down at every opportunity when she's wanting to find out what's going on, because she's the closest the film comes to a really nice sympathetic character. It's a shame that she just becomes kind of a pawn by the end of it.
Yeah.
Hopefully the box office will build with word of mouth, even though next weekend they've got some stiff competition next weekend.
Yeah.
But hopefully it will, with all this good word of mouth and social media, it'll do well. $12 million is not bad for this kind of movie.
No.
And it's the debut, directorial debut
of Joel Edgerton.
Thank you.
Some movies.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think once it does hit home DVD, you could say that you more than get your money's worth at the Redbox for that. That's for certain.
Excellent.
He wrote another really good thriller a couple years ago. Was it called The Box or The Square or something like that? It was Australian. It was directed by his brother.
Mm-hmm.
Huh.
That was a movie about, disposing of a corpse, and it was a really good thriller as well.
That was the one where the box showed up at your house.
Oh.
Or I'm thinking of another one.
No, you're thinking of the one with Cameron Diaz.
Thank you.
What was that called?
That
had one word, too. Maybe that was The Box. Maybe it's The Square was the one that Joel Edgerton wrote.
Yeah.
But Joel Edgerton, I think we first noticed him in Animal Kingdom as an actor.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's the first time I noticed him. And then he's had a pretty good career. He's had a pretty good run. Even he was Ramses in last year's Exodus, which nobody liked. But he was fine.
Yeah, but everybody says he's the best part about that movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say, Warrior, I really enjoyed him, man. Was that Tom Hardy with him in there? They make a great pair in that.
They do, and he's got a lot of range. He played sort of, he's a boxer in that, and he was all buffed out, and then he's in The Gift, he's kind of this creepy weirdo with his weird clothes and his weird hair.
Yeah, he was strong in The Great Gatsby.
Yeah,
I thought he was one of the strongest people in that there.
Yeah.
And he was the father in the Short Life of Timothy Green.
Mm-hmm.
He's showing a lot of range. He's going from genre to genre there.
Yeah,
he was almost Doctor Strange, as I understand. Yeah. So he was in the short list for that.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's Doctor Strange based on a Marvel comic book. We saw another Marvel comic book movie, the new one last week. We all three saw this one.
Yeah.
Fantastic Four.
We're family.
If we do this, we do it our way.
What if we say no?
Say yes.
Oh my gosh, Michelle, what did you think of Fantastic Four?
Just across the board, it looked like something you see on the Sci-Fi Channel. It looked like one long trailer. The production value and the score is by Philip Glass and Marco Beltrami, who I love both composers, but I just
we're slumming.
Yeah, it was like it was called in. Yeah. It just even. I mean, Kate Mara's wigs have been getting a bad rap over on social media,
Michael reviewed it at our site. What do you give it, 2 out of 5?
Yeah, I would have given it.
I thought that was
one.
Generous.
That was really
generous.
Makes
me appreciate these other movies from Tim Story's two first movies.
Yeah.
I mean, at least Jessica Alba was sort of sexy, and those were much more lively.
Oh, yeah, and you couldn't, this is another thing that drives me crazy. I saw a commercial for the film over the weekend, and the picture was sharp and clear and bright, and you watch the film in the theater. I don't know if it was maybe a problem with the projection, but it just looks dingy and dull and, shot through a pair of nylons or something. Mm. It's just awful.
Four solid actors could not save.
They
mean,
were, they
well, they
were
had nothing
bad.
To do.
All four of them just... complete. Nobody stole it. They all four lacked any sort of charisma.
Yeah,
especially Kate Mara. I mean, what a dull performance. I mean, she was the invisible girl. She was invisible in the movie. She added nothing. My biggest problem with the movie, it was all origin story.
Pretty much. It looks like it. Well, it jumps to a year later, and it's like maybe this is the 40 minutes that supposedly was cut from the film, but it's so deadly dull. And once there is the big battle at the end of the film, it seems to be over in like a minute.
If you took your stopwatch and you timed how much Reed Richards was stretching his limbs about, it might have been 10 seconds. Seriously, they didn't do anything with their powers.
Well, another thing in the trailer, in every commercial I've seen, they have Ben Grimm, the Thing, hanging from the landing gear of a helicopter and then letting go and just sort of plummeting like a bomb onto a battle site. It's not in the movie.
Yeah, of all the things to cut, why the heck would they cut that?
Let's cut the exciting stuff.
Director Joshua Trank, who did Chronicle, who many people, including myself, really liked, shot himself in the foot last week when he took to social media, Twitter, and said if it was the movie he had wanted to do and edited, it would have received much better reviews, which everybody got screenshots of, and the tweet was quickly yanked, but by that time...
He was playing the victim.
Now, did he say that the day it opened or like the night before?
It was right around then. I didn't catch the date, but it was right around there. And, he was supposed to direct one of the standalone Star Wars movies. Well, that's over with now, too. Yeah. And he didn't show up at Comic-Con, which was very telling. So
sounds like he's got an attitude problem.
Yeah. And the villain in it, the portrayal of Doctor Doom is just awful.
Toby.
Who's so terrific in Rise of the Planet of the Apes.
Yep, Toby Kebbell.
Yeah, he was terrific in that. He's good before his transformation. Mm-hmm. He's kind of this kind of obnoxious, really smart guy in it. But, oh my goodness, what a disaster.
Michael B. Jordan's in it?
He
makes no impression.
Yeah, he drives a car fast and kind of acts cocky towards his dad, but that's about
it. Who was that black actor that played his dad? Because they found somebody with a lower voice.
Yeah.
He's a character actor.
Yeah, I've seen him around. He wasn't very good. Nobody was good.
Yeah, I know, of course, in the opening scene, they show Reed as a young boy talking about his aspirations as he grows older, and you hear his teacher, and I'm like, that's Homer Simpson. What is he doing here? And sure enough, it's Dan Castellaneta.
who's his fifth grade teacher, but then who's his 12th grade teacher a couple years later, who's become his new high school teacher.
What kind of school district is this? it's just awful, and I got to echo the that Oscar-winning song, Let It Go, Fox. Let It Go back to Marvel Studios. And, of course, I've heard actually from a couple of critics, and, of course, online, they said the way to do a Fantastic Four movie is Mad Men it. Set it in the early 60s. That would be wonderful.
A couple weeks ago, we were making fun of the Roger Corman 1994 Fantastic Four movie, but I would rather sit through that again than sit through this new one. And it makes those ones from about 10 years ago with Jessica Alba look like, Captain America in comparison.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I can understand the thought to make the Thing a CGI character. But here, there's none of the charm that's that they're the whimsy of the character from the 60s. He bashful Benji is nowhere to be seen there. You hear him say it's clobbering time once.
Yeah, once.
But it seems so out of place.
Oh, and, by that time, it was cringeworthy, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I was like, where's your shorts, man? Come on. I kept on thinking back to Mallrats.
I think it was about 5 minutes before the movie ended, he finally said. Then the awful last scene where they're trying to, what are we going to name our group? Oh, that was embarrassing.
Oh, it's just dreadful. And Stan Lee is nowhere to be seen in the film. Mm-hmm. If you're looking for a cameo of Stan, he ain't there. Yeah. He saw the script and he stayed away.
Maybe he filmed one and insisted that they cut it out when he finally saw the final cut of the movie.
Oh my gosh! Yeah. This is just awful. And I hope. Well, I was reading online today that Fox has the license for 7 more years. Hopefully they'll give it up. But I think there's just going to be such a stink around a stench around the characters from this that nobody's going to be able to do anything. It's like the Lone Ranger. There's not going to be another Lone Ranger movie for at least 10 years. And it took 20 years for the Captain America movie to come out after the Matt Salinger film in 1990. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So there's going to be this sort of smell around them for a while. Yeah. So, you know, I wouldn't hold my breath to see anything with those characters for a long time. Mm-hmm. Although with Marvel getting it back, they could use the great villains from the comic series, Galactus and the Mole Man and those characters.
Well, they had Galactus in the second Jessica Alba one, didn't they?
Well, they referred to him, and he was kind of a shadow, you know.
Well, he was kind of a constellation.
Yeah.
I think in the comic book he looked like sort of a giant samurai. I think that would be hard to pull off in a movie.
Yeah, well, it might look a little silly there. But I think you can do a good Fantastic Four film. Yeah. They just haven't really done it yet. Yeah. You know,
they brought Silver Surfer into that same film too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he looked pretty snazzy. Yeah. But this will be forgotten about pretty soon. There, I imagine it'll be in the $2 shows. You know, within by Labor Day or so.
Well, apparently a better sort of science fiction movie is called Air.
Scientists, engineers, doctors being whisked away in the night. Is the government hiding these people in underground shelters?
Our priority is the safety of all the American people.
Completely unfamiliar with this. Sam Moffat is going to be reviewing it at WeAreMovieGeeks.com. Later this week, but Michelle has seen it. Michelle, tell us a little about Air.
I have seen it, and both Sam and I really love this film. It's a sci-fi film starring Norman Reedus and Jaimin Hansu. It opens in select theaters. You can also find it on demand, and you can order it off of iTunes. It's set in the near future. Their breathable air, non-existent. Virtually all humanity has disappeared, and those chosen to reestablish society reside in a controlled state of suspended animation. Two engineers are tasked with guarding the scientists who are in hypersleep. It's really well done. The score is great. It feels like a movie, a retro movie from the 70s and 80s. There's only two characters in the movie.
Excuse me. Did Robert Kirkman have something to do with this? I think I read that he did the script of it or something.
He did.
Creator of Walking Dead?
He's the executive producer on it. So it showed at Comic-Con. It's really well done. I spoke yesterday, actually, on Sunday with Jaimin Hansu about the movie, about the characters, about the storyline. So we'll have that this week, and we'll also have Sam's review as well. But it's really one of those smaller type science fiction. If you're looking for something here in August to definitely see, whether it's showing it, you know, at Los Angeles, New York, one of the bigger markets, or if you order it flying or on demand.
So there's only two characters. It's Jaimin Hansu and Norman.
They are the custodians.
It's an all-male cast. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. With flashbacks, that type of thing.
So
it feels like 12 Monkeys. It has a 12 Monkeys that, you know, they are the custodians. They're keeping the scientists who are asleep alive until the air, the contaminated air,
reads
back to normal.
Are there big science fiction scenes, or is this kind of more of an intimate,
low-budget? Exactly. It's a very intimate. It doesn't feel low-budget, but it feels like a John Carpenter feel to it, an Alien feel to it. I think it's just really well done. I hope people see it.
Okay, the other movie that opened Friday that I think came in seventh was Ricky and the Flash. We're going to review that here in a few minutes because we have some strong opinions on that one. But this Friday, a whole bunch of movies open. Straight Outta Compton.
Hey, that was dope, eh? You're listening to Compton's very own Ice Cube, Eazy-E, and Dr. Dre. I got to tell you, you are witnessing history.
We still haven't seen that. You guys are seeing, I can't go, but you guys are seeing, I think, tomorrow night?
I'm going to see it tomorrow night, yes.
Plus, we already have our junket feature up on what Ice Cube and F. Gary Gray and the actors who portray NWA, we already have that up on the site. So that's really an insightful interview.
And then Melissa Thompson has seen it, and we'll post a review by her later this week.
Correct.
It's gotten great advance buzz.
Oh, right. Yeah, it's tracking to right now it's tracking between 60 and 80 million opening.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
Is it in the 90s at Rotten Tomatoes right now?
Is it?
Yeah. I think so. Yeah.
It's really well done. Whether you like hip hop or not, definitely it's supposedly a really great biopic.
The other big one that opens this Friday is The Man from U.N.C.L.E., which Jim and I are seeing tonight. Michelle saw it a couple weeks ago.
I have. Warner Brothers Pictures, they're releasing Guy Ritchie's film. It's this really stylish international adventure and origin story about super spies, Napoleon Solo and Ilyan Kuryakin from the United Network Command for Law and Enforcement. It feels like a movie that was pulled from a canister buried 50 years ago, and from the art, the fashion, and especially the music. It's a great score from Daniel Pemberton. He captures the instruments, the feel, as if you were watching a 1960s espionage film.
But do Robert Vaughn and David McCallum have cameos?
No. However, the original score does make a cameo.
Right? Oh, it does.
Very when I spoke with Daniel Pemberton, and that interview went up today, we spoke about, did the original score have a cameo? And indeed it does.
Oh, good. Oh,
so Guy Ritchie does a fabulous job with the film. The actors are great. Henry Cavill
plays Napoleon.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And Armie Hammer plays
Ilya.
Yeah, you know,
he does.
It's of course based on the old TV show from the mid-60s.
Mm-hmm.
Turner Classics ran some of the, I guess, the pilot movies a couple weeks ago. It's interesting because really Robert Vaughn's Napoleon was the main character for, I guess, the first half of the first season. And and if you watch those pilot movies, McCallum is just barely in it. Apparently McCallum was getting all the fan mail.
Oh yeah.
So after the first half of the first season, they really boosted his character, and it really became the story of these two guys. And it was supposed to just be pretty much Robert Vaughn's show, which was, I guess, why it's called The Man from U.N.C.L.E. instead of The Men from U.N.C.L.E.
You know, with all these spy movies out this year, from Kingsman to Spy, Melissa McCarthy's Spy, to the upcoming Spectre movie, I mean, it's a really fun year for spy movies. And this is just, it's got a retro vibe to it. Whether or not you like the original TV show, I think people will really enjoy it.
Yeah, it's got the it girl of the moment now.
It does.
Alicia Vikander.
Yeah.
And,
I like her.
Yeah,
You know, really, she's really smart in it, but sexy at the same time. So I think people who were fans of, including definitely fans of the show, will really like it.
Yeah, I believe that Hugh Grant is playing their boss, Mr. Waverly.
He does. He does.
There, so that's kind of a switch there.
Yeah.
So Mr. Waverly was pretty old, as I recall, in the Leo G. Carroll in the original series.
The original series, I think, it was accused of being sort of a James Bond ripoff. But Ian Fleming was actually one of the developers of the original Man from U.N.C.L.E.
Yeah, you're talking about Ilya Kuryakin, and I hearken back to an episode of Mad Men in which young Sally Draper is really enjoying Ilya Kuryakin an episode and watching The Man from U.N.C.L.E. But yeah, he was quite the heartthrob back in the day.
Oh yeah, David McCallum, sure.
Oh yeah, and he's on a show right now too.
Year was that? Was that early 60s?
Yeah, I want to say like 64 to maybe 68.
That sounds about right.
That was an interesting trivia question someone posted on Facebook. What TV show took over Man from U.N.C.L.E.'s slot on NBC? And it was on Monday nights.
I don't know.
And it was Laugh-In'. And if you recall, after Rhoda Martin did their sort of comedy bit at the start of the show, they'd open up the doors and go into this cocktail party. And as the camera was panning around that first episode, you saw Leo G. Carroll as Mr. Waverly.
Mr. Waverly,
with somebody. So I thought that was a nice sort of tip of the hat to the show that they whose place they took.
Yeah. Guy Ritchie really captures. He really does. I mean, look what he did with the Sherlock Holmes movies.
Well, I hope it's better than the second Sherlock Holmes.
No, I really
it was better than the first Sherlock Holmes.
Oh, I mean, I'm not a fan of the interpretation of Sherlock Holmes. And I know they're very popular, but
he's doing the next this upcoming King Arthur movie for Warner Brothers as well,
with Charlie Hunnam. Yes. I read about that in Entertainment Weekly. It should be interesting.
So that opens this Friday, and I guess Jim and I can share our thoughts on it. Michelle apparently liked it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Underdogs opens this Friday. At least we think it does. That doesn't look very good.
Yeah, that's a
the Weinstein
Argentinian animated film, CGI animated film.
You just can't get away with a subpar CGI movie anymore.
Yeah,
I know last year they had a Wizard Return to Oz or something like that. That looked kind of like 10-year-old CGI.
Yeah,
The Underdogs kind of reminds me of that.
Yeah. I don't know if that's gonna pass muster here.
Yeah, there's a good chance. Unless they have a screening that I can take my kids to, there's a good chance I may end up skipping that one.
I have a feeling they're not going to screen it for anybody, I'm guessing.
No. And Phoenix opens Friday.
Phoenix will.
And Michael Hafner will be reviewing that at WeAreMovieGeeks.com. And what's that about, Jim?
Well, from what I understand, it's set shortly after World War II in Germany. It concerns a woman who was in one of the camps, was taken away in one of the camps, and I guess she was injured. Lost part of her memory. They had to do a lot of sort of reconstructive surgery on her face. Mm-hmm. So after the war, she tries to start her life over. She marries a fella, and then as her memory starts, I guess, slowly coming back, she realizes that this might have been the fella that turned her into the Nazis, that sent her over to the camps.
Sounds like a good drama.
Yeah, it might be pretty good. It's from IFC Films. Yeah. So.
And a couple other movies that we're going to be seeing this week. Diary of a Teenage Girl stars Kristen Wiig.
And was it Stellan Skarsgård? Is that the actor's name? Yes.
Stellan Skarsgård's son.
That's his son, yeah. Think of it a moment. He was on True Blood. Alexander Skarsgård?
Yes.
He was in True Blood. And, this is based, as I understand, on a graphic novel. It looks like, at least from the trailer, I don't know if you saw the trailer, Tom, but they're integrating some of the images via animation into the film. And it's sort of like a terrific film from, I guess at least 10 years ago, American Splendor, which was just fantastic. They put some of the animated cartoon comic book images in there, and it's really good.
Yeah, we'll have a review of that next week. And Jimmy's Hull is also screening this week. We'll see. That's Ken Loach's new film.
It's set in Ireland, as I understand.
Yeah, it looks interesting.
Yeah, or was it 60s, 50s, something like that.
I did see the trailer the other night. Those are the movies that we'll be reviewing next week at the We Are Movie Geeks podcast. Let's not forget Ricky and the Flash. We saw that last Monday night.
They're all grown up now.
You think because you screwed up once you don't get a second chance?
That I hate.
Hey!
Why did you walk out on my daughter?
Our daughter.
Julie hates you.
That may be. And I have to live with that every day of my life, but now you have to live with the pain you caused.
You reviewed it. I thought you gave it, would you give it 3 out of 5?
I gave it 3 out of 5.
I thought that was ridiculously generous, Jim.
Well, I could probably go to 2.5 because I think the first half of the film is fairly entertaining. Yeah. And then, boy, does it go off the rails in a big, big way. It does have some problems. I will admit that. Actually, I was reading on Facebook some of my friends there who were just, Meryl Streep can do no wrong. Yeah. They were saying, I saw Ricky the Flash. I loved it. And then, like, 2 comments later, they said, boy, they spent a lot of time seeing it at that bar. And I was like, yeah, they did.
Aren't you guys getting sick of Meryl Streep doing no wrong? Wouldn't it be more interesting if she, was really bad in a movie?
Well,
that I would like to see.
Maybe like in what, She-Devil? That was 25 years ago.
I don't know if she was bad in that. I don't think I ever saw She-Devil.
I heard it was. I saw bits of it, and I was like, this is pretty lousy.
What was the one that came out about the same time with Bruce Willis and Goldie Hawn?
Death Becomes Her.
That was Robert Zemeckis, wasn't it?
Yeah. There's some neat effects in that.
That's kind of a pretty fun, dark movie. I don't think I've seen that one since.
And if she's in a film and it's released towards the end of the year, guess what?
She's taking
one of the 5 slots. Yep. Look at Into the Woods last year. The Giver, she was in The Giver, done in the summer.
Oh my gosh.
The same thing's going to happen this year. Ricky and the Flash, released in the summer.
Suffragette.
Yeah. Mark my words. Yeah. She'll be one of the 5.
Yeah. The Giver is a lousy film, so there's one for you.
Yeah, I really hated Ricky and the Flash. Meryl Streep plays this woman who had sort of abandoned her family 30 years earlier to become a rock star. She records one album, which I guess wasn't a success because she never followed up and became a grocery store cashier and plays in a band called Ricky and the Flash at this dive bar. And there's just so many songs, songs in their entirety in this dive bar that she's playing with her band. And you can tell these musicians that are in her band are just so slick and so seasoned. You can just tell by looking at them. They're probably really famous studio musicians that they got for this movie.
Well, hey, her boyfriend is Rick Springfield, for goodness sake, Mr. Jesse's Girl.
That's right. And he's apparently had some surgery on his eyes, some plastic surgery, which I found really distracting. And he seemed younger than her.
It's really telling, though. It only opened up in one country, the U.S., 7 million at number 7.
The plot sort of kicks off when she gets a phone call from her ex-husband, played by St. Louis's Kevin Klein, and apparently their daughter has been left by her husband, so she travels to, I forget what city she travels to.
Indianapolis.
Okay, to comfort her daughter, who is played by Meryl Streep's daughter. What's her name?
Mamie Goomer.
Goomer. Thank you.
Mamie Goomer. I don't... Terrible in the movie. She, you first see her, she runs down the stairs when her mom walks in the door and starts screaming and spitting, and she's so angry at her mother. Well, you know, by the end of the movie, they're going to have some big group hug.
Well, it's a terribly written part, Tom. Yeah. I don't know if anybody could pull that role off.
Well,
you know, it's just a poor script.
She's in the end of the tour.
I saw her in that earlier in the day before I saw her in Ricky. But yeah, I was going to say, could I zero in on when the movie really jumps the
Go
rails?
For it.
Okay, it's a little bit of a spoiler, but the thing is, the daughter Julie, her husband has left her for a coworker, and Ricky and I think Pete is Klein's character name, and Julie go out for ice cream, and they come outside and they see the car of the woman who's taken Julie's husband, and she's got those goofy little stick people cartoon figures, you know, put on stickers on the back of her van or whatever, and it's got her and her kid and her dog, and she's added Max, the husband she's taken. And of course, the daughter flips out. She takes her ice cream cone and throws it at the back of the car, and then starts looking around the area for her to see if she's in one of the bars or restaurants. And she spots them in one of the restaurants, and she's wanting to go in there, and Ricky and Pete are restraining her, and then finally they leave her outside, and Ricky and Pete go inside the restaurant to confront her. I'm like, who in the world would do that?
Terrible scene.
Their daughter could trash that car. She could stick her head through the window and you know, cut her neck. I mean, what were they thinking? This is just so that Meryl Streep's character can deliver a couple of burns. A couple of really nasty comments to her, and everyone in the audience can go, ooh, ooh. Yeah. And it's just ridiculous. It's like they leave her out. I'm like, what? Why are you doing that? You're embarrassed.
It's written by Diablo Cody.
Oh, yeah. It's got an Oscar-winning director, Oscar-winning writer, three-time Oscar-winning star.
Oh, yeah.
It's just a bad movie. And then she flies back to wherever she was singing in her dive bar.
Tarzana.
And then she gets an invitation to the wedding, which she didn't think she was going to get invited to. So she goes back to Indianapolis, but she never interacts with her daughter once she's flown back. There's one scene where her daughter is like walking down the aisle, I guess is one of the maids of honor or whatever, and she like freezes up. It's a horribly acted scene, and Meryl Streep just, what she say, go or something like that. So they interact for like 5 seconds, but there's never a final confrontation between the mother and the daughter. And then it ends with the ubiquitous wedding toast, which was just horrible, and she goes, oh, I don't have any money, but I do have my music. So she jumps up on stage. Well, then they bring her band in. Now, how did the band get there?
There's the whole thing about, oh, she can't really afford to fly back out to Indianapolis, so the Rick Springfield's character pawns his guitar, and I'm like, what was this guitar worth, $1 million? Because the whole band is out there with her.
They fly the whole band in, and then they sing a song, and everybody dances, and everybody hugs, and
well, you know, and plus they have, when they first start up, they've got the reaction shots of the other families and, you know, or married couples in the audience, and they're all horrified at their singing rock and roll at this thing, and I'm like, you guys are in your 50s, what did you listen to when you were teenagers? You weren't listening to Rudy Valley, for God's sakes.
It was a horribly written scene, and then somebody serves some drinks at this wedding reception, and Rick Springfield goes, oh, are these free? Like a guy who's been in a band all his life doesn't know how wedding receptions work.
I'm telling you, Meryl, she puts these, you know, she's in these clunkers in the summer, but she saves the Oscar stuff for end of the year.
But we were talking a little bit before the broadcast with someone who'd seen it, and I would say, you know, I will give it a little bit of credit. They avoided having the Pete character, Kevin Klein, get back together, you know, sexually or romantically with Ricky's character. They almost go there. That's just after the obligatory, oh, let's bond over some pot scene. And luckily, the Kevin Klein's character comes to his senses, and we didn't have the scene with them both all waking up the next morning in shock that they had slept together overnight. You know, luckily, he comes to his senses.
All right. So we saw three new movies last week. Two were terrible, Fantastic Four and Ricky and the Flash, and one was good, The Gift. So we did not like Ricky in the Flash. Jim liked it a little better than me.
Yeah, I'd say the first half hour, 45 minutes, is kind of fun.
Yeah, but I guess one of the biggest disappointments about Ricky and the Flash is that it was directed by Jonathan Demme, who I think is a director that we respect and has had an interesting career, and it's just so bad. Jonathan Demme has been directing movies for over 40 years now. His first movie was Caged Heat.
Prison as a place of punishment.
Caged Heat. Enter the female jungle of women's prison, USA. A seething hell of steel and stone where bodies behind bars ache with hunger for a man. Any man.
Oh, which they showed at St. Louis International Film Festival they last did. Year, believe it or not. I actually introduced that event. There was a band that was playing songs about Roberta Collins, who was one of the stars. But Cage Heat was made for Roger Corman in 74 and had, who was in that? Rainbow Smith and Barbara Steele played in the Warden in that.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And Erica Gavin, who was Russ Meyer's original Vixen, right. was in that. A lot of wonderful 70s cult starlets were in Caged Heat. And Demme directed it with a lot of style, brought in a lot of interesting sexual politics into it. So that was quite a good debut for Demme. He followed that up with Crazy Mama, which was also for Corman, which was kind of the gangster lady series that Corman produced. You had Big Bad Mama with Angie Dickinson, and you had The Lady in Red with who played Nancy Drew?
Oh, that was Pamela Sue Martin.
That's right, Pamela Sue Martin. Yes. You had Boxcar Bertha, which was directed by Scorsese.
Yeah,
and that had Barbara Hershey.
That's Crazy Mama. That's the one with Shelley Winters.
No, you're thinking of
I know she played Ma Barker in
That was
Barker.
Bloody Mama.
Bloody Mama.
That was had
right.
De Niro and Brewster. Crazy Mama had Cloris Leachman.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh.
So he worked for Corman, Fighting Mad. I remember seeing that at the theater. That was sort of a kind of a rural Death Wish, kind of a Walking Tall knockoff with Peter Fonda and Lynn Lowry, who became something of a scream queen. So he made these movies with Corman, and then he came into his own with some really quirky, interesting movies throughout the 80s, starting with Handle with Care. Remember that one?
With Paul Amet.
Yeah, a.k.a. Mm-hmm. Citizens Band.
Yeah, kind of I guess it was made to sort of jump on that CB radio craze in the mid-70s, but I know a lot of reviewers kind of picked up on it being a little more than that, more than just a cash grab, that he was trying for something kind of quirky and interesting and a sort of a multi-character thing.
Melvin and Howard in 80 also had Paul Amet. I guess Paul Amet kind of went through a brief period where he was kind of a big deal after American Graffiti.
Sure.
Right. It was Aloha, Bobby, and Rose.
Oh, yeah.
And in these Jonathan Demme movies, but he's kind of disappeared. I don't know what happened to Paul Amet.
Yeah. I guess when the more American Graffiti sequel didn't really take off, I guess he was pretty much done with the leading man roles.
Yeah.
Melvin and Howard won 2 Oscars.
Yes, it did. Yeah.
Mary Steenburgen, Best Supporting Actress.
Yeah. She's terrific in it.
Isn't she?
I'm Howard Hughes.
Well, listen, I believe anybody can call themselves whatever they want.
That's a really entertaining film.
Yeah, I love that movie.
Jason Robards. He's just in a few minutes of it, but the scenes between them in the front of the car are so great. And it's a really, really entertaining film. Charles Napier's in it.
Charles Napier was a Jonathan Demme regular.
So it was nice to see him pop in.
And Demme's sort of fallen, I would think. I mean, look at the characters in Ricky and the Flash compared to the characters in some of these fun movies like, Something Wild and Married to the Mob. Especially the gay character in Ricky and the Flash was the son. And he was so wimpy and so whiny and so uninteresting. But who was the gay character in Married to the Mob? It was Charles Napier, who was the big square-jawed guy from the Russ Meyer movies, and he played this gay hairdresser, and he was funny. That was a great character.
So I guess with Melvin and Howard, that was a sort of ticket to the big studio stuff there.
Yep.
Because Swing Shift was certainly a big one there. I know that that Goldie and Kurt. Well, that's a film that they actually met on and hooked up on. I believe.
Yeah. And somebody was nominated for Best Supporting Actress.
Christine Lottie?
Yes, she was nominated for Best Supporting Actress for that.
It plays the best palette or something like that. Yeah, it's great. Set in the mid-40s or early 1940s. Really good period
still
film.
Still a delightful film every time it shows up, on cable.
Oh, yeah. And I guess Goldie and Kurt had some chemistry there.
Yeah, I guess.
But see, even in these movies that where he was really coming to light, he was also directing TV. Like he did an episode of American Playhouse. Before that, he did an episode of Saturday Night Live. So he's kind of always
He's kept working. Something Wild is a really funny movie with Melanie Griffith.
Oh, yeah, and Ray Liotta just being really evil and sort of compelling.
I've never done anything like this before.
Don't worry, Charlie, I have.
Interesting. Jeff Daniels is great in it, too, sort of the straight man.
I think that's the movie that Scorsese saw and gave Ray Liotta the lead in Goodfellas because of his work.
Oh, yeah.
In Something Wild. I just watched that recently. It's on Netflix, Something Wild.
Yeah, I remember after that came out, a lot of comics fans were saying, that's the guy that should play the Joker. No. And then, of course, that didn't happen. But, I guess around the same time he did the that great documentary, or documentary concert film with Talking Heads.
Yeah, Stop Making Sense.
Stop Making Sense.
Which is just really entertaining.
I think that's where Jonathan Demme seems to feel most comfortable is in these documentaries.
Mm-hmm.
At least in the second half of his career. Even he did Swimming to Cambodia, which was a filmed version of a
Spalding Gray
monologue. Spalding Gray was a monologuist and writer, and he had a part in Apocalypse Now, and then he ended up killing himself. It took him a long time to find his body or something.
Yeah, it was in the river around New York or something. That's a shame.
Swimming to Cambodia. Then Married to the Mob, which I mentioned. That's a funny movie.
Oh, that's hysterical.
Everybody loves Angela DeMarco.
No!
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 What are you going to do about it?
Frank loves Angela. But he's married to his job.
Matthew Modine and the terrific Alec Baldwin in it. And playing the nasty mob-connected husband of Michelle Pfeiffer.
Yeah, and an Oscar-nominated performance as Tony the Tiger by Dean Stockwell.
Yeah. Mercedes Rule played his wife, who was just crazed in it. Just like, I know you're doing my husband. I know it.
Yeah. And those movies were fun, quirky comedies. But then he was hired to direct Silence of the Lambs, which, of course, won Best Actor, Best Actress, Best Screenplay, Best Picture, and Best Director for Jonathan
That was one of
those
where it won the five
big. Yeah. And that was unusual. People always, whatever they say, this movie's opening too early to be considered for Oscars.
Yeah.
Well,
February
it came out. And I recall they had the Oscars a few weeks after it opened. And Billy Crystal introduced Anthony Hopkins and Jodie Foster to give out an award. And he said, folks, they're going to be here next year.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, yeah.
And remember, Billy Crystal the following year came out,
wheeled out. With the mask on, the Hannibal Lecter mask. Yeah.
It was the first movie to win Best Picture that was released on VHS before.
And it's a horror movie.
Oh, sure.
A horror movie wins Best Picture.
Oh, yeah. And like I say, so early in the year, but people remember this day. It's an iconic film.
Oh, yeah, so quotable.
It's wonderful.
Pure psychopath. So rare to capture one alive.
So close to the way you're going to catch him, do you realize that? Oh, Clarice, your problem is you need to get more fun out of life.
But when you look at Jonathan Demme's career after that, he sort of kind of went downhill, at least as far as narrative features go. He directed Philadelphia in a couple years later, and that won Tom Hanks an Oscar. I guess his first Oscar, two in a row. But, you know, he didn't really bring a whole lot of style to that film. I don't think it's known for its directing. I haven't sat through it again since it was new.
Yeah, there were some people speculating that this might have been sort of his apology for the Buffalo Bill character in Silence of the Lambs, but I never thought that Buffalo Bill was meant to represent the LGBT community or anything like that.
People will find something to complain about and everything.
So Hanks is great as his boyfriend, and I remember his Antonio Banderas.
That's right.
Very entertaining. And Denzel Washington's pretty great in it too.
Beloved may have been the movie that sort of really hurt Jonathan Demme's career. That was based on a book by Toni Morrison.
Mm-hmm.
It starred Thandie Newton and Oprah.
Oprah was trying to win.
And her clout at the time, nobody, in 1998 was a bigger voice. And she, I'm sure, was promoting it endlessly on her TV talk show.
Mm-hmm. She was.
It just could not get people in the theaters.
It bombed bad. I think it really hurt. In fact, he didn't direct another film for 4 years. After that, not even any documentaries. And that was The Truth About Charlie. Was that a remake of Charade?
Yeah.
I never saw that. With also with Thandie Newton.
Thandie Newton, Mark Wahlberg.
Yeah. Mark Wahlberg.
That didn't really do much, did
it?
No.
And then The Manchurian Candidate. I mean, that was sort of a director for hire on that one, too. Everybody loved John Frankenheimer's direction of the original 1962 version of The Manchurian Candidate. But this remake, which also had Meryl Streep.
Yeah. Denzel Washington.
Yeah.
And Liev Schreiber.
Yeah, that's right.
Playing Meryl's son in it, I believe. saved.
Yeah.
Although he's the highlight of that movie.
Yeah. Wasn't William Hurt her husband in that?
I never got to see the thing. I just love the original so much. Yeah. I had no interest in seeing a remake of it, really.
Yeah.
And then he does Jimmy Carter, Man from Plains in 2007. So he switches back to documentary.
He's only directed 3 films in the past 11 years. Rachel Getting Married, that got Anne Hathaway her first Oscar nomination. Mm-hmm. Yeah. A Master Builder, which we mentioned.
Yeah.
That was a filming of a play with Wally Shawn.
Yeah, yeah. I saw that. It was part of St. Louis International Film Festival last November, and I got to see and review that.
Yeah. So. But his heart really seems to be in these documentaries, especially these music documentaries.
Yeah, yeah.
He's made 2 about Neil Young.
Yeah, I just noticed
in the past
that.
10 years.
I see 3, actually.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
Yeah, and I'm curious about what Storefront Hitchcock is. Is that maybe about
That's Robin Hitchcock. That's another rock concert movie.
Oh, okay.
It has nothing to do with Alfred Hitchcock. Robin Hitchcock was a musician, or is a musician, I should say.
Yeah.
He has quite a following.
Boy, that, like I say, that stopped making sense. That's a toe-tapper. That's a great one.
His new movie, Ricky and the Flash.
He's done a lot of really good TV. Yeah. I mean, Enlightened, A Gifted Man, earlier on Point of View. He did, and Jim and I were talking about The Killing, AMC's that first season was fantastic, but he did 2 episodes of The Killing.
Ricky and the Flash, not recommended. He's 72 years old. Maybe he'll make another great narrative film, or maybe he'll just stick with documentaries, which seems to be his strength.
Oh, sure.
I want to talk a little bit about silent films. We don't really spend much time talking about silent films here at Weird Movie Geeks, the podcast. But last month they had Barnes & Noble had its annual sale on for the Criterion DVDs and Blu-rays, which are so awesome. They're always jam-packed with extras and always just superb transfers. But they're so darn expensive. I mean, you can, if I had bottomless pockets, I would own all of them. But I don't, so I always save my money and I'll buy 4 or 5 in July. But one of the ones I bought last month was Safety Last, starring Harold Lloyd, 1923.
Oh, good one.
Oh, my gosh, yeah. It's the picture quality in this. It looks like it might have been shot just a year or two ago.
Yeah.
It's just so crisp and clean. I think a lot of folks might not be that familiar with Harold. They probably grew up watching or seeing that iconic photo of him hanging onto the arms of a clock.
That's probably the most iconic photo in all of the silent era.
Yeah. But his films weren't as easily available people as...
They were out of circulation.
Yeah, I read a biography of Harold, and he toyed with the idea of selling the rights to Safety Last and a couple of his other films to network television, but he was wanting something like $200,000 for one broadcast which was ridiculous back then.
But they weren't even in the Blackhawk catalogs.
Oh, no.
Back in the 50s and 60s. And I used to go to the library when I was, 12, 13 years old, and I would check out Charlie Chaplin movies. And I would watch them on my Super 8 and 8mm projectors over and over. So I was pretty well steeped in Chaplin. And then Keaton I sort of discovered on VHS. But I had not seen Harold Lloyd films. You and I saw The Freshman a year or so ago.
Yeah.
They played it at Webster University, a 35mm print with live music by an orchestra. And I was just blown away. I thought that was one of the very best silent comedies I had ever seen.
Yeah. I didn't discover him until the mid-70s when I started going to college in Chicago. Every Friday night, the Art Institute was running Harold Lloyd films with a live musical accompaniment. Mm. And I was like, I never knew about this guy, and he's just fantastic.
Oh, and I had never seen Safety Last until I picked up this Criterion disc.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's a glaring omission, but it's not anymore. And he plays the glasses. I think his name is actually Harold, but they refer to him as the boy.
Yeah, actually, in the film itself, he gets a pay packet from the department store he works at, and it says Harold Lloyd.
The stub says Harold Lloyd.
But
on
in The Freshman, he's Harold Lamb.
Okay.
So
he gets a job at this big department store in Los Angeles, and he's trying to impress his girlfriend who lives in a different city.
South Bend.
Yeah, and he tells her that he's the manager when actually he's just kind of a lowly employee. So the first hour, I guess, or 45 minutes, is all this wacky comedy in the department store. You know, a movie it reminded me of, and this may sound stupid, but it reminded me of Who's Minding the Store with Jerry Lewis, which was directed by Frank Cashlin, had sort of a similar, you know, madcap visual style that would have been right at home in the silent area.
Oh, sure. Era. Sure. Well, I'm sure that Lloyd was an inspiration to Mr. Cashlin.
And that's Jerry Lewis, perhaps.
Oh, he was one of the 36 founding members of the Academy.
Oh, Harold Lloyd was?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he had a heck of a career outside of films.
Look at his list on Internet Movie Database. He was in everything.
He made more movies than Chaplin and Keaton combined.
Yep.
He was very prolific. He made 12 silent features in the 1920s, and Chaplin only made 4.
Yeah. I think most of the silent features he made are still available. I know that a lot of his short subjects are lost, which is unfortunate.
Well, in that commentary, I think they mentioned that he had control of the negative, so he took really good care, was very protective of his films.
That's why they weren't all over TV. I think he wanted such a large amount of money to run them on TV because he just didn't want them on TV. He didn't want them interrupted by commercials or cut for time or whatever. Mm-hmm. So he wanted to keep them pure and, you know, seen in a theater, really.
So many great gags in Safety Last. And you mentioned the quality of Criterion's transfer. I mean, you can read windows in downtown Los Angeles.
Oh.
I mean, it's just phenomenal.
Yeah. It's never looked better.
And then there's, of course, the famous last 20 minutes where he's in order to, I guess, bring publicity to this department store, the manager offers $1,000 reward if somebody who comes up with a gimmick to bring people in. And he has a friend who's known as the human fly who can climb buildings. And this guy was actually a real human fly. But the guy can't do it because he's being chased by this cop. So Harold Lloyd's Harold has to step in and climb this 12-story building.
His buddy says, I'll take over once you get to the second floor.
And of course, that never happens. And it's about a 20-minute sequence. It's just the most amazing thing. I think this is my favorite silent comedy of all time. And he's climbing floor to floor, and a mouse climbs up the leg of his pants.
Oh.
And there's a photo shoot involving a gun. Halfway up,
there's a plank that gets jutted out of a window, you know, and he has to dangle from that, and it goes on and on. And they talk about when it was first released, and people were actually fainting in the theaters at this thing.
Well, it looks like he's climbing up this building, and there's no double exposure, but apparently they explain it in the commentary. They put, I guess, a couple of stories on top of another building, so if he fell, he wouldn't fall off, 12 stories.
He would hopefully hit the mattress. Hopefully!
But then they say they threw a dummy just to see what would happen, and the dummy, fell 20 stories.
Bounced right off that mattress.
It's
interesting. They in one of the bonus features on it, and the bonus features on Criterion stuff are always terrific.
Mm-hmm.
They use some animation techniques to try to recreate how they think they shot the film, because there are no on-set photos from that time period. They think they used three different buildings and built up facades, like little two-story fake buildings on top of the roofs of these buildings, it's really incredible. And boy, does it work!
It does. And let's talk about the very last shot. He gets up on the roof and he grabs the girl by the arm, and there's a tar patch on the roof. So he takes 4 steps through the tar patch. First step is left shoe comes off. The second step is right shoe comes off. The third step is left sock comes off, and the fourth step is right sock comes off. And then it fades to black, and that's the end of the film.
That's perfect.
It's so brilliant, and you would never see Adam Sandler or Melissa McCarthy or Will Ferrell or all the great comedy stars of today pulling off anything resembling that. Even The Artist, which won the Best Picture 3 or 4 years ago, won the
feature,
Oscar.
Yeah.
And that was an homage to the silent films. Mm-hmm. And they did a lot of silent film type gags. But there is more gags in 10 minutes of Safety Last than there were in the entire The Artist.
It just is so... Even, but the stuff before the buildings, I'm glad you talked about that. The stuff in the department store is really clever. And the fellas mentioned on all the terrific commentary tracks on there. It's Leonard Maltin and a fellow named Carell, who was a Harold Lloyd historian. Mm-hmm. I forget the gentleman's first name.
Harold Lloyd. Yeah, interviewed him.
And there's photos of him helping Harold, looking at the old films and negatives and all that.
Lloyd didn't die until the early 70s.
But he talks about how well some of the gags play with modern audiences, and there's a sequence in which the guys have to hide from their landlady that I remember when I first saw it, just got screams of laughter.
So we highly recommend going out, even if it's not on sale anymore, going out and buying the Criterion version of Safety Last.
And if you like that, get the freshman.
Definitely.
That's on Criterion also.
That is. I'm going to have to break down and buy that one. All right, we're going to have to wrap it up, although we do want to say happy birthday to a special We Are Movie Geeks friend, as that is, of course, Snoopy. How old is Snoopy? Anybody know?
Oh, gosh. He must be about 64, maybe? Okay. 65?
Says he first appeared in 1968, August,
oh,
today.
Oh, he was there earlier than 68.
I think
Snoopy,
the cartoons were made before.
Well, the comic strip started in 1950, so okay. I'm not sure if he was in that first year of the strips.
And
or
didn't he have a different name or something?
Gosh,
or am I wrong about that?
He was more of a puppy, of course, in those early strips.
Mm-hmm. It says August 10th, 1968, Charlie Brown and Lucy surprised Snoopy with a birthday cake. And Fox has got it on all their social media.
Okay. And the reason is the Peanuts movie opens November 6th.
That's right.
So look for coverage of that. And there already has been some coverage at WeAreMovieGeeks.com.
Looking forward to it.
All right. So next week we'll be back to review Straight Outta Compton and maybe Underdogs, Diary of a Teenage Girl, Man from U.N.C.L.E. There's always so much going on in the world of movies. I'm signing off. My name's Tom Stockman.
Michelle McHugh.
Jim Batts.
And listen to us again next week, please.
Black leather, rock, rock, rock. Black leather, ta, ta, ta. Black leather, black leather.
Oh, naughty state. Hello, Don. Hey, hey, hey.
Black leather, black leather, rock, rock, rock. Black leather, ta, ta, ta. Black leather, hip, hip, hip. I got that feeling, black leather rock.